Peter, can you hear me?
Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And welcome to all of you all around the world, especially in the United States and Great Britain and Canada, where I have so many, many wonderful listeners, but really all over the world. Israel, hello, Israel. You know, we are not a huge group, but we're a very, very important group. The people listening to this radio show are among the leaders and potential leaders to stop this plague of neurotoxic substances being sold to tens to hundreds of millions of people around the world. And also, you know, probably millions getting shock treatment, certainly a couple hundred thousand probably in this country, even a little lobotomy thrown in, and God knows what else is being done, involuntary treatment, outpatient involuntary treatment. There's just so many things that are out there that need to be confronted. And the folks listening to this show are doing a lot of that confronting, or someday you will be doing it. And if you're only listening to this show for comfort and your sense of identity, but you're not ready or may never be ready to take on reform work, bless you too. Delighted to have you listening. Delighted to have you getting whatever strength you can from the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. Your radio friend, Peter. As of the last week or so now, wherever you are, there's a simple way for you to dial in to three of the best resources there are on psychiatric drugs and shock treatment. we've now got the links that you can use at any time. It'll bring you to the sections on my website that have hundreds of articles and begin with a good introductory commentary and then references to various sections under which the articles are divided by subject in a manner that's easy to handle, that we are continuing to improve. Almost every day I work on this and improve it. It's absolutely free. So one of them is antipsychotic drugs and TD. You can get there by just going onto your website and sticking in the window 1, 2, 3 antipsychotics. And my really big and carefully worked out website about antipsychotic drugs and TD will pop up. Easy to remember, 1, 2, 3 antipsychotics. I've also got up a really good and evolving one on antidepressants, and guess how you get there? It's really easy. 1, 2, 3 antidepressants. And then finally, I've had up my ECT page with, again, hundreds of articles divided up. You can search them by topic on the ECT page. Now you can get to the ECT page real simple. If this were an audience, I'd say repeat after me. 1, 3 ECT. So there it is. 1, 2, 3 antipsychotics. 1, 2, 3 antidepressants. 1, 2, 3 ECT. And you can get right to these information centers. There's so much on them. I turn to them all the time. If I want to find a PDF of an article that's really important in this area, instead of fumbling around through papers or fumbling around on my website, as good as it is, I can just poke onto 1, 2, 3, either ECT, antipsychotics, and antidepressants, and find it and download it and use it for good purposes, not purposes that make money, good purposes. One other thing, put aside the dates November 10th through 12th of this year. Just put them aside. I'm going to be co-conferencing in Columbus, Ohio with Pam Popper. I don't think it's up yet I don't think she's quite got it up yet, but it'll be up soon. So it's Pam Popper. You can check her out. And we're going to be talking about two different things. I'm getting into a whole new area with Pam. We're going to talk about the importance of nutrition, not cockamamie nutrition to pump up your dopamine or your serotonin, but genuine, good, solid, historically proven, evolutionarily sound nutrition. And I'm going to be joined there by Peter Gertze, the wonderful Danish physician who's doing some of the very, very best work in psychiatry now. He's been on my show a number of times. We'll be on again. He's already scheduled for a couple more times. So save November 10th to 12th to come to Columbus, Ohio, and all the data will be up November 10th to will be up soon. My guest today, have you ever sort of passed somebody kind of for short communications or exchanges over the years and you've thought, gee, this is a really wonderful person. I ought to get to know this person. And it never really evolves fully. You think about him often enough that you imagine, in my case, that I've had him on my radio show, and I don't think I ever have before. His name is James Davies. And before I tell you more about him, James, are you on the line from Great Britain? Hello?
Hello. Can you hear me, Peter?
Oh, yes. Good, good. Got scared for a minute. There you are.
Okay. So, excellent.
I realized after we hung up the phone that you'd never been on my show. I went and looked it up, and no, you'd never been on the show. And folks, all I can say is that that's just some sort of glitch in the brain functioning of your esteemed host here, because James Davies should have been on this show four or five times already, and he will be on, God willing and James Davies willing, again and again. James is a psychologist. He got his PhD at the University of Oxford in 2006. And the degree is in social and medical anthropology. I mean, obviously, this is a person we want to talk to. He's a reader, which is like a professor. Is that right, James? A reader is pretty close to a professor?
Pretty much, PC, yes. Pretty much.
Okay. So he's pretty much close to a professor in social anthropology and mental health. He's at the University of Roehampton, and he's a practicing psychotherapist. And interestingly enough, it's not just in the National Health Service, but something on this show or a later show that he and I can talk about. He has worked for MIND, that's capital letters MIND, which is a giant British organization, part governmental, I think part supported by contributions and from the public. It's a complicated organization. I've had some work with them in the past that deals with mental health in Great Britain. I met James when he interviewed me for The New Scientist. And later he interviewed me for one of his three books, and this book is Cracked, Why Psychiatry is Doing More Harm Than Good. It's a very important book. I love the subtitle. Anybody who says that psychiatry is doing more harm than good is a brave, courageous, and honest man. And he's also done a book of a more existential nature, The Importance of Suffering, The Value and Meaning of Emotional Discontent. That's from Routledge in 2011. And he's co-authored another book on emotions. And the reason that I had him on today, but I should have had him on many times before, is that he is the editor of a new book, The Sedated Society. And I've already had on a number of people as a part of my project and making up to having him on a show three or four times already. I've already had on Peter Gertze, who has a chapter in the Sedated Society, Bob Whitaker, a chapter in the book, and Joanna Moncrief and Sammy Tamimi. And all these people I've had on before, but I had them recently for the show. Really, really top people in the field of psychiatry and psychology. And I'm said, Ms. Davies, to have you on the show at least. This should have happened a long time ago. So there, and I, oh, and I have, he has a surprise for me. He's going to tell me a surprise story that relates to me and one of my books. So, hi. Hi, James.
Hello, Peter. Excellent.
Thank you. For the introduction. Go ahead.
Yes. Oh, well, great. Well, I'm, hopefully you can hear me now. Is am I coming through loud and clear?
Clear as a bell.
Oh, brilliant. Well, look, thank you so much for having me on your show. I really, really do appreciate it. And of course, thank you so much for contributing to the Sedated Society, which, you know, is a wonderful book. And as you say, has contributions from, you know, the leading lights in the critical movement. And so thank you so much for getting involved in that project with us. We really are honored to have you and are so appreciative.
Well, thanks very much.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we had a little chat earlier, and you asked me about the Sedated Society and what were some of the main points and why I, you know, decided to try and put that team of people together in an edited volume. And I suggested, well, maybe I could go back a little bit in my biography to give you a kind of background story as to where the book came from. So if that's okay, maybe I could say a little bit about that.
Yes, please. Really would like to learn more about you. I want folks to know about you, how you evolved, who you are. I think that'd be a really great thing.
Okay, great. Well, basically, it all really starts. So I'm going to start with my starting out as a psychotherapist in the NHS in England around about 15 years ago now. And I was a very young, very enthusiastic somewhat naive psychotherapist working in an outpatient unit in the NHS, seeing people for long-term psychotherapy. You know, and back then, you know, I had my suspicions about psychiatric medications, but it wasn't until I really started working with people one-on-one that I began to realize that psychiatry seemed to be doing some harm to many of the patients I was working with. And I began to sort of develop suspicions with respect to whether or not the drugs were really as efficacious and safe as most of my colleagues had, you know, really been led to believe through their training and so on and so forth. So it was my experience on the ground as a therapist that really began to open my eyes to potential problems of the medical model and the medications that model advocates. But anyway, I remember there was one key moment. I was working with this young lady, very intelligent young woman. She had been in and out of hospital for many years, diagnosed with bipolar. And I've been working with her for about 4 months. And anyway, one day she came into the room and she said, James, I've really got to tell you something. I've stumbled upon a book. A friend recognized me, and I'm just aghast at what I'm reading, and it's having a profound impact upon me. And I asked her what that book was, and she responded, it's a book called Toxic Psychiatry. Now, Peter, you may have heard of that book.
Yeah, I love that. You don't know how you warm my heart. That, and I've said this so often to people on this show. You wouldn't know this unless you listen to a ton of the shows. That so often I hear for the first time on the radio when I'm interviewing my guests, time and again, that the toxic psychiatry changed the direction of their career in some way or their lives. This is just especially at my age, this is like, wow, okay, it's been worth it. thank you for that. Then what happened, James?
Well, absolutely. And so I hadn't heard of the book at that time. I wasn't really familiar with the critical literature at that point in my career. So I was intrigued, and she started to tell me more about the book. But as the weeks rolled on, this book led her to kind of rethink her relationship to psychiatry and rethink what she'd been subject to over the previous 7 years. And she began to entertain the notion that actually the so-called care she'd been receiving was actually doing more harm than good. And the reason she hadn't recovered was owing to the interventions to which she'd been subject and the fact that she had begun to identify with someone who was terminally ill and someone who could not overcome their difficulties because they had this so-called chronic condition, et cetera, and so forth. So she, in essence, embarked upon a critical assessment of what she'd been through over the last 7 years, and her conclusion was what she'd been through wasn't doing her much good at all. Now, I remember raising this issue in group supervision, which comprised therapists, psychologists, but in particular a leading consultant psychiatrist who was quite well known in the Oxford mental health system, which is where I was working at the time. And as I spoke of this patient's, if you like, awakening as I experienced it, the psychiatrist's response was, "It sounds to me as though this patient is on the cusp of another psychotic episode, and we should be upping their dose of whatever particular medication they were on at that time." And I just remember hearing this and being astonished at this response, because it seemed to me for the first time this patient was beginning to critically assess whether or not the care she'd been receiving was actually helping her. And it seems to me for the first time this patient was beginning to feel empowered and, you know, moving towards an understanding of a predicament that was far less medicalized and far more humanistic. And here you had a patient who seemed to me to be on the beginning of change in a positive way, having that change pathologized. And that just really struck me. It struck me that this particular psychiatrist seemed completely unable to accept, and this was an intelligent person, don't get me wrong, this was a very well-qualified person, a person with high status, high influence, etc., and yet completely unable to accept that the very practices that they embrace and distribute could actually potentially cause people harm. And that opened my eyes to the notion that in the name of helping people, psychiatry may in some ways be doing harm. And that led me on a journey into firstly reading books like yours and other members of the critical community, as I'd refer to it. And as the years went on, I decided to begin to undertake research of my own and, you know, become part of that community. And that ultimately materialized in a book that I researched and wrote and ultimately published in 2013 called Cracked, which was really written for the general reader. I wanted to reach the people who were at the receiving end of psychiatric medications and diagnoses and communicate to them all that I'd learned about the problems with psychiatry over the last sort of 10 years or so. So that's really how I got into critical psychiatry. But when I published that book ultimately ended up in the hands of somebody called Luke Montague, and I gather you may be speaking to him shortly. Is that right, Peter?
Yes, because he has a chapter in your book, and we're arranging for him to come on the air too.
Yeah. So, so he read the book and he wrote to me and said, "Listen, James, I'd love to meet you. Can we meet?" And I said, "Of course." So we met at my university, and Luke, within the first 10 minutes, tried to convince me that I needed to start an organization that was really set up to campaign for change in mental health, to campaign to reduce our reliance on psychiatric medications. Now, I said to him, "Look, I'm too busy, I can't do that." And so I spent the next sort of 10, 15 minutes trying to convince him that he needed to start the organization. And by the end of the meeting, we had both decided that we probably should start it together. So we started an organization called the Council for Evidence-Based Psychiatry, which has been now running for about 3 years. And this is essentially an organization set up to provide evidence of drug harms to the people in institutions in the UK who can make a difference in terms of policy change. So we're very active in Parliament. We are secretariat to an all-party parliamentary group in Parliament, which is a group of parliamentarians who've all come together from different political parties to lobby government to institute change around topics related to the harms that these drugs are causing. So we're engaged in that. But we're also engaged in doing our utmost to bring attention to the critical voice, to publicize critical psychiatry whenever it is we get the opportunity. And so one thing we did in service of that agenda was to hold a big conference here in London a couple of years ago, to which we invited the leading lights in critical psychiatry, Robert Whittaker, Sami Tamimi, Joanna Moncrief, Peter Gertscher, yourself, et cetera, and so forth. And that conference had such an impact, and people were so impressed by the quality of the presentations and the power of the material offered on the day, that we really, really thought, look, we've got to lock this down. We can't just let it stop there. So I approached all of the presenters and some others to ask whether or not they'd be willing to write up those presentations, expand those presentations into chapters that could be put together in a book. And that was really where the Sedated Society emerged from. And it's been a wonderful experience putting the book together. The authors have been very accommodating. They're remarkably knowledgeable in their particular areas of interest. And the one thing I say to people when talking about the book is, look, don't be put off that I'm the editor. the people in the book are really excellent, and so are the chapters. So that was a long way, or a long-winded way of telling you how the Sedated Society as a book was born.
Well, actually, it's very concise, very, very interesting. I participated, folks, in the conference that he's talking about by Skype because of an illness in the family. I had to stay here. So I didn't know before about the scope of the conference and how many people you had there speaking, and that the conference was the origin of this book. I mean, I was pretty much down to how do I arrange to talk on Skype for an hour or whatever it was and take audience questions. And I had a fabulous time. It worked out really, really well.
Yeah.
But I didn't have a sense of the scope of this particular conference. So that's you've been doing a lot of important organizational work. It's really great to be learning about what you're doing. How do you relate much? Does your organization – well, first of all, what is your organization? Tell us more about how many people are involved or whatever you're comfortable telling us about the evidence, the Council for Evidence-Based Psychiatry.
Yeah, well, essentially, it is a campaigning organization. So it's about forcing change or campaigning for change in the political community. So once Luke and I decided we needed to start an organization like this, we quickly got a website together with very, very useful information that we offer to people who were struggling with dependency on prescribed medications such as benzodiazepines and antidepressants. And we give a lot of advice as to how best to manage withdrawal, et cetera, and so forth. We recruited a number of members, so people like Peter Kinderman and Sami Tamimi and Joanna Moncrief and Peter Gertscher joined as members of CEP. But I think the most important development for us as an organization was becoming secretariat to this parliamentary group that I mentioned earlier, because really what it allows us to do is to bring these arguments regarding the overprescribing of psychopharmaceuticals and the harms that these drugs are causing to millions of people in the UK. It enables us to bring these arguments to the heart of the political establishment in Westminster. So last year, we held a big seminar in the Houses of Parliament to which we invited Robert Whittaker to talk about his argument. You're familiar with the argument, Peter, which is that wherever we're seeing drugs being most aggressively prescribed, we're seeing mental health disability claims not going down, we're seeing them going up. And we're seeing this correlation in diverse societies, in Sweden, in Iceland, in the UK, in Australia, in the US, et cetera, and so forth. And when we put that data alongside other evidence that shows the longer you are on these medications, the less likely it is you're going to be back to work and in recovery than people who are on the medication short term, a picture begins to emerge that it's the medications themselves that are driving up mental health disability. So really important arguments like that, you know, we're able to give a platform to in the Houses of Parliament. We've just been working with the British Medical Association, which has put out a call to ask for the NHS to provide provision for people who are withdrawing from or trying to withdraw from psychiatric medications such as benzodiazepines. There is no provision out there in the NHS at the moment to help people who are in severe states of withdrawal. There are a couple of withdrawal charities, but they're poorly funded. They're run by wonderful people, but they simply don't have the resources to meet the demand that's out there. The demand for help when withdrawing from these medications. So we've been working with the BMA to get the NHS to start to fund a 24-hour helpline to help people in withdrawals. So that's an example of one of the projects we're engaged in at the moment. So really, it's all about policy change. It's all about making tangible change happen on the ground to improve the lives of people who are being adversely affected by these medications.
Wow, it's just amazing all you're doing. And I haven't had much any familiarity with the Council for Evidence-Based Psychiatry in Great Britain. So I'm just delighted to be hearing about all this. I think that I think there's a big change going on that isn't. It's mostly rooted, I think, in Great Britain and in Denmark with Peter Goetze, and I think there's some people active in Germany as well, where people in the establishment, that is people who work in the National Health Services or who are teaching at universities and have significant roles, are really changing their views on psychiatry. I don't see this happening here yet. I see lots and lots of millions and millions of people have totally now gotten the picture of how harmful psychiatry is. And so with the public, everything has changed dramatically. But it's worse with the media now because since the advent of direct-to-consumer advertising, the media didn't want to deal with anything about psychiatric drugs at all. We just had a suicide here of a very prominent and much appreciated a judge in New York, and it looks like she had just been started on antidepressants within 3 weeks beforehand. But the New York Times won't even mention that. They call it a mystery that she killed herself. Yeah. It is mentioned in another newspaper in New York, but not in the great New York Times. And the Washington Post, I'm sure, won't either. Here things are locked down more than ever while the public becomes more and more aware nonetheless. And many, many professionals are changing their minds who are not in the heart of the establishment. But here, if you had talked about toxic psychiatry the way you did so unwittingly about what the results would be, they might have fired you here in the U.S. for a crime like that. So there's more room in Great Britain. Do you think that's so?
It's what I hear. It is what I hear. I mean, I remember speaking to Robert Whittaker about this, and he said something similar. Of course, you have the wonderful Mad in America site, and you have really wonderful key individuals in the U.S., such as yourself and Robert and others, who and Paula Kaplan and you know, et cetera. Wonderful people who have been, you know, leading the charge for years. But I think you're right in saying that in terms of the relationship between critical psychiatry and the establishment, I suspect in the UK, that relationship is probably a little closer than in the US. I mean, I think this parliamentary group we've got is really important in this respect. But, you know, you could argue that, you know, the Brits are very pragmatic in some respects. If you can show parliamentarians that this prescribing epidemic, and we are in the midst of a shocking prescribing epidemic, by the way, and as you know well, there's in the UK over 15% of the adult population is psychiatrically medicated at any given time. And in the US, that figure is over 20% of your adult population are on psychiatric meds. This is a astonishing number of people out there taking these drugs. A huge amount of money is being spent on them. And if you say to parliamentarians, not only is this going on, but at the same time, these drugs are costing the economy a huge amount of money, firstly in terms of what it simply costs to prescribe them, but secondly in terms of the disadvantageous effects they're having on the population, not only in terms of the side effects they elicit, but also the withdrawal effects that can accompany coming off them, et cetera, and so forth, then they tend to listen. So we're very careful in making sure all the arguments we make are thoroughly evidence-based and that the arguments speak to the concerns of parliamentarians. And you know, parliamentarians, want... in my view, there is a lot of negative feeling about politicians sometimes, but the politicians that I've met who were interested in mental health, the majority of them are deeply concerned about mental health issues and ultimately want the best solutions for people who are suffering. And if you can put forward powerful arguments to them as to what needs to change in order to help more people more of the time, then my experience is they will be receptive. And that's certainly, the case with the parliamentarians I've spoken to. So that is a positive. But to go back to your question, is the establishment more willing to listen in the UK than the US? My sense from the people I've been speaking to is that probably is true at the moment, at least.
Yeah. And it's reflected in who I have on my show. So many folks now on the show are from Great Britain, as well as Peter Goetze, who's from Denmark. You know, I worked very closely with the U.S. Congress and House of Representatives in the 1970s when I basically developed an international campaign that stopped the return of lobotomy and psychosurgery. And I was able to really enlist them on these issues very, very much so. Did press conferences with members of the House of Representatives and convinced, now in those cases, they were the very left. And in the Senate, worked with the very right, who thought that it was immoral to be doing these kinds of lobotomy things. But in recent years, the sound in the ears of our parliamentarians, our politicians, the sound that they hear is drug company money rushing into their heads and into their offices and into their campaigns. Getting the ear of them around the disaster here with drugs, which is obviously even worse than in your country and more longstanding, it's impossible to get a voice because of the drugs, with very few exceptions. And the folks who do some critical work, they're not going to align with the really major critics here in the country. So it is different, but it's encouraging that things are changing overseas. We're so locked in now. The pharmaceutical industry has a lock on us that's much greater than in Great Britain or in Canada. I mean, you can buy a drug. We recently came across a medication here that was $350, and it could be bought from a reputable Canadian pharmacy for $50. This is incredible. That's like what is it, seven times. And it's simply a reflection of the lock that the pharmaceutical industry has on the U.S. And I'm sure it's already got a lock on Canada, too, to some degree. So probably the medication's worth about $6, maybe, and it's selling for $350 in the U.S. Yeah. It's a bizarre situation. Just bizarre.
Yeah.
Well, how is your life going now that you've, in the last few years, become increasingly more an activist? How's it turning out for you?
Well, I'm far more busy than before. I mean, I sometimes miss the days when it was just me spending the majority of my time either teaching or in the library researching and writing. And I think those days are long gone, least of all because I now have two little kids at home, and which is a wonderful thing, but obviously they take up a lot of time and energy. And of course, because of the campaigning I do along with Luke and other members of CEP in Parliament, I have probably less time than I used to research. But nonetheless, you know, we try and carve out time when we can to honour what goes on in the library and get our thoughts down on the page. And I think it's important that we continue to remain scholars first and foremost. And that's certainly something that I continually strive to do. But it is interesting. I mean, what you were saying a moment ago about the 1970s and how it sounded to me, you were saying that there was more will in the political community to listen to some of the criticisms that were being leveled against mainstream psychiatry
Absolutely. No, in 1973 or two, without my involvement anyway, there were hearings held in Congress lamenting that we had 100,000 to 200,000 children on Ritalin. I mean, imagine that, 100 to 200 sounded like a plague to the congressman who was holding the hearings. And I hadn't even gotten involved in that issue very much at that point in time. I don't know the last time we had any hearings that were remotely comparable to that. I mean, the biggest event would be, I think it's now back in 2010 that I testified as a major expert on suicide and violence from antidepressants, and it was a committee of the Veterans Affairs Committee, and I was actually the lead person, and then I got 35 or 40 minutes, and the Psychiatric Association got 10, you know, and the VA got 10 minutes.
Right, it
was like a reversal of my known reality. but I'm sure they got hammered so bad they didn't do any follow-up hearings, for sure.
It's
a more grim picture here, but it's also very exciting. There's a lot of wonderful stuff going on. I mentioned to you that I'm getting more involved now in working with people who want to change methods of delivering services to develop psychotherapists and other folks who know how to help people without drugs and to develop clinics and services where that can be provided. So I'm working on a whole new level now with people who want to change the way the aspect of our system that is free enterprise, which is smaller and smaller, you know, delivering services that will save money for corporations and ultimately, you know, maybe for the government too, you know, and how to deliver services that really, really help people, starting with nutrition and therapy with medical backup when that's needed for the physical illnesses, but not for the mental health issues. A lot of interesting things are going on here. I'm sure not complaining about not having an effect, but it is clear every time I talk in any depth with folks from Great Britain that you guys are ahead of us, and it's partly because the pharmaceutical industry isn't as powerful there. But it's also ironic because, you know, we have a freedom of speech, under the Bill of Rights. We have freedom of speech here. But I do believe that anybody working in a government service here would have much less freedom of speech than someone like you or Joanna Moncrief or Sammy Tamimi or others working in the NHS have. Much less freedom of speech here.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to know because I'm not as certain or clear as to how things operate in the US as they do in the UK. But I think things have. I mean, I wouldn't underestimate the role pharma plays here in the UK. I mean, pharma has had an immense impact on Britain. The conflicts of interest between leading British psychiatrists with the pharmaceutical industry are legendary in the UK. You know, we've had Big Pharma shaping mental health provision here as well in quite dramatic and covert ways. There was a really interesting Health Select Committee report, which is the equivalent you have in the US as a congressional inquiry. We had one here in the UK in 2005, and it looked at the influence of Big Pharma on medicine in the UK. And it was quite a damning report, and it showed quite clearly the power Big Pharma has in the UK. So its reach does extend to the UK as well, and I think it's done a lot of damage. In fact, I'll give you one example, actually, while we're talking about it. There are, in mental health in the UK, two of the most powerful documents are questionnaires called PHQ-9 and GAD-7. I don't know if you've heard of these, Peter. I'm not sure you have them in the UK.
We do.
You do have them.
I see the Q9 all the time is used in physicians' offices here. Why don't you describe it, though?
Yeah, well, okay, so PHQ-9 and GAD-7, so it's used throughout primary care in the UK as well. And so basically, these are questionnaires that are administered by primary care physicians, GPs in the UK, to people to help GPs work out whether or not the person sitting before them either has depression or anxiety, okay? And you fill these questionnaires in, you get a score, and the score determines where you are on the depression scale, et cetera, and so forth. Now, one of the most powerful critiques of both of these documents is that they set the bar for what constitutes having either a form of anxiety or depression for which a drug is required. They set the bar for that very, very low. Now, here's the thing. What the tens of millions of people in the UK who have filled in these questionnaires over the last 15 years and have got drugs as a consequence probably don't know, almost certainly don't know, is that they were developed by, their distribution was paid for throughout the NHS by, and their copyright is owned by Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, which incidentally makes one of the most prescribed antidepressants and one of the most prescribed anti-anxiety drugs in the whole of the UK. So here you have a company that is setting the bar very low for what constitutes getting prescribed a drug, while at the same time as manufacturing that drug. And that's been going on in the NHS for the last 15 years, and absolutely nothing has been done about it. And that's just one example of how pharma exerts influence in the UK.
You know, in our country, these little things that are given out that doctors use to prescribe for, I mean, if you have reached a certain number of points on the checkoff list, then, you know, you get a drug, actually has the name of the drug company in little tiny fine print in one corner. So it's been no great mystery where it comes from. Nobody cares. And I think the fact that people are caring about this on a parliamentary level in the UK is really, well, it's credit to you and to a lot of other people there, and it's certainly not happening here. We're getting into the subject of your book chapter. Folks, the book chapter, and again, this is James Davies, and the book he edited with a bunch of us in it is The Sedated Society: The Causes and Harms of Our Psychiatric Drug Epidemic. It's available in the U.S. and in the U.K. from Paul Grave, Macmillan. And the title is Political Pills, which is interesting. Pills. Psychopharmaceuticals and Neoliberalism as Mutually Supporting. We don't have a lot of time, but let's talk about that. And don't be afraid to talk a little bit of politics. I myself am getting more and more dismayed with everything political in the U.S. mostly. Don't get to focus on a lot of other things. But tell us more about that all-encompassing title you have there.
Yeah, well, actually, it's relevant to what you were saying earlier about how in the 1970s there was more openness to the critical perspective. Now, my thesis is that's understandable, and it's understandable why There was less tolerance of criticism post-1980s. For the following reason, post-1980s is a very different style of political economy comes to dominate in the US and in the UK, which is known as neoliberalism or late capitalism or new capitalism, as Richard Sennett refers to it. But basically, it's the style of capitalism that's inaugurated under Reagan in the US and under Thatcher in the UK. Now, irrespective of what you think of that capitalism, and some people support it and some people don't, I wasn't interested in taking a position with respect to that. I was more interested in looking at the ways in which that style of capitalism has allowed the pharmaceutical industry to get away with what it's gotten away with over the last 30 years. So essentially, what I'm arguing is you can't just look at medicine and big pharma for the causes of our current prescribing epidemic. You have to go beyond that and look at the wider social context in which those two institutions operate. So, and that context is the political and economic one. So I'll give you an example. So one of the key policies that neoliberalism introduced from the 1980s onwards was something called deregulation. And deregulation was a central policy right through the 1990s as well, and it still is today. And what this essentially meant was removing restrictions, rules and regulations on industry, you know, regulations, something we used to refer to as red tape, in order to improve the profitability of industries and increase market competition, etc. So through the 1980s and 90s, this policy of deregulation occurred in most of our industrial sectors, so in energy, communications, in transport, banking, and of course in pharmaceuticals. And in fact, if you look at the key neoliberal economist of the late 20th century, someone called Milton Friedman, he went so far as to say that all regulation of pharmaceuticals should be abolished, because in his view in the 1970s, regulation was too strict, it was too risk-averse, and therefore it was hampering the development and distribution of effective treatments, in essence stopping drugs that could save lives from reaching market. So he proposed that all regulation should be removed and drugs be given literally free and direct access to markets. And then it would be up to the consumers to determine whether or not any drug was successful or not. So if the drug was bad or harmful, consumers simply wouldn't consume it, and therefore the drug would fail. But if the drug was good, then people would and the drug would thrive. So in essence, what he was saying is you don't need regulation, just leave it up to the market, and the market will weed out the bad medications. And that was sort of neoliberalism at its extreme. Now, governments in the US and the UK didn't go for that because it felt too extreme. However, what they did go for was a kind of regulatory compromise. So what that essentially meant was they took the regulation of pharmaceuticals out of the hands of the state, and the state was, you know, for example, in the UK, we had the Department of Health, and the regulators were not linked to industry in any way, and they independently regulated the drugs to see if they were fit for purpose, etc. It took regulation out of the hands of the state and handed it over to the industry itself. And what that meant was that the regulatory agencies in the UK, for example, became 100% funded by the pharmaceutical industry. It was no longer a state-run regulator. It was largely privately run, and it was also run by ex-industry professionals. So if you look at the MHRA in the UK, which is our regulatory agency, today it's 100% funded by fees from the pharma industry. It's led by ex-industry professionals. The chief executive of the MHRA was a director at GlaxoSmithKline for many years prior to his appointment. And what I argue in the chapter is that this form of deregulation has led to a form of regulation that's very lenient, that better favors the interests of industry over the interests of individuals and the general public. Go ahead, Peter. You were going to.
Yeah, let me. Do you know enough about RFDA to compare the development here of our FDA, which is actually looking more and more like your MHRA. But could you address that as well?
Very
if,
similar.
If you don't have that, it's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I do. I know less about the FDA, but it's a very similar process. So the FDA was literally a public institution. It went through reforms and became more of a private institution. So today, the FDA is about 70% funded by fees from industry. So it's not as close financially to industry as our regulatory agency, but it's pretty close nonetheless. And so a similar arrangement occurs at the FDA, perhaps to a slightly lesser extent than the MHRA in the UK. But, you know, this is a very worrying situation because what you have in the EU right now is that most nation states have a regulatory agency. And all of these regulatory agencies are competing for licensing fees from pharmaceutical companies. The thing here is if a company gets a drug approved by one regulatory agency in the EU, then it's very easy for them to get it approved everywhere else. So you have the regulatory agencies competing for the custom, but the best way to ensure getting the custom is to set your regulatory thresholds very low. And that makes it attractive for a pharma company to choose your regulatory agency over the one down the road, for example. So in essence, what we have right now with our regulatory agencies in the EU is a market of regulatory agencies, which is producing a kind of race to the bottom in terms of regulation. And the consequence of that, of course, is that drugs are getting to market that perhaps shouldn't be getting to market, and drugs that are causing harm aren't being taken off market when, in fact, they probably should be. So to recap, to understand why pharma is getting away with what it's doing, you have to go a step further back on the causal chain and look at the style of political economy, the kinds of policies that it's privileged, and how those policies have kind of created a fertile ground for the problems we're seeing in big pharma. From which the problems in big pharma have been able to flourish.
It's a really, really good and interesting explanation. I'm not going to offer any alternative views right now. I think that I want to have you back, actually, to talk some more about this. We've only got a little bit of time left. I would add to it that the FDA here only in recent years started to take money, allegedly for just to help out and speed up the regulatory process. It was taking 10 or 12 years. We had the worst of all possible worlds. It took 10 or 12 years to get a drug approved, and then it was really not at all regulated properly when it got approved. So we had the worst of all possible worlds. And they tried to solve in part, I think the rationale was, well, we got to get things done sooner than 12 years, so we will we'll take money from the drug companies to help speed it up. I think that there's another aspect of it, which I'm sure you're very well aware of, which is that a lot of the control that doesn't come directly from the drug companies, at least in the U.S., comes directly from the U.S. Congress, where the pharmaceutical industry is so incredibly powerful and gives so much money out to everybody, from the presidential and vice presidential candidates to the senators and to the congressmen and God knows what under the table, to all of them and to the bureaucrats. So that even if industry itself wasn't directly involved with the method you described, they're involved through the buying of Parliament and the Congress and the executive branches as well. Yeah. And, of course, they're also buying the medical schools. They're buying, everything is they're buying the associations, the AMA, the APA, and so on and so forth. I've always blanched at the concept neoconservatism. But I want to actually explore this more with you on another show. What do you say to that? I want to hear you really elaborate your political analysis. I want to think it through with you. I think it is time more and more for those of us who have seemingly divergent views on things to be talking them through a lot more. And you're very eloquent in your description of the problem from the economic viewpoint. I mean, I first started to have some of these concerns when I heard an American conservative talking about Reagan, whom I admire in many, many ways, saying that one of the wonderful things Reagan did was to integrate business with our educational institutions, higher education more, so that there was more cooperation between the two. And of course, you don't cooperate with big business, you just get eaten by them. What was supposed to be this really good idea of, you know, let's have our scientists working with industry and developing new products and making a lot more progress in the technical and scientific areas through the coalitions between higher education and industry has really turned the higher education into, in my area, an arm of the pharmaceutical industry. Yeah. You can take a neuroscience project. You can take a neuroscience textbook in college, and it's fundamentally written from the perspective of a pharmaceutical industry. So this is a big deal. This is the thing you're talking about. It's really quite huge, and we could talk about it more. We've got about 2 minutes left. Are you still working in the areas of the more existential and psychological? Is that something else we could talk about in the future?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think the project I'm working on now is still dealing with politics and the relationship between economy, politics, and mental health, and how political economy has shaped the style of mental health that has evolved in the UK over the last 30 years. And my argument ultimately is that this style of mental health provision isn't really about serving individuals, it's about serving the needs of the economy. And that's why it's not working, because our outcomes in mental health are really bad, and they you know better than anyone, Peter.
I think the issue for me, and we should do this on another time, the issue for me is that when you think about what benefits the individual, we haven't yet found any kind of large governmental organization that benefits the individual, I don't think. So I'm not sanguine about going toward more government control necessarily at all, because then you have no recourse at all. So problem for me that I haven't solved. I'm not claiming to have solved it.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I mean, it depends on what the government institutes, doesn't it? So the simple argument that government has all the solutions, it isn't fit for purpose, because it doesn't. Yeah. It all depends on the solutions instituted by government. You know, if they work, they work.
Let's wrap
up. If they don't work, they don't.
Jim, I got my wrap-up notice from my wonderful engineer.
Okay.
Thank you for
that.
You're listening to James Davies. He's got a website that's worth looking at, Council for Evidence-Based Psychiatry in Great Britain. He's a professor. His latest book that stimulated me to get him on here when he should have been on years ago is The Sedated Society. Has stunning, interesting book chapters, an excellent introduction to the whole overall issue of this. So thank you so much, James, for being on. Thank you very, very much. Good night, my wonderful audience. Good night.